as you can, high enough to see who you are, little man. Life sometimes is cold and cruel. Maybe no one else will tell you, so remember that you are.
Intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Tyra Banks from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah. To end toxic masculinity, we need to stop saying toxic masculinity. And this article is by Jacob Tobia. How one well-intentioned phrase pushed men away from the movement meant to help them too. Men are miserable right now. Men are doing terribly, like bad, bad. As a group, their mental health is in the toilet. They're flailing and don't see a place for themselves in the world anymore. And a sizable subset of them have decided that the best way to cope with their present misery is to ruin everything for the rest of us. As a non-binary author and feminist leader who's dedicated my life to transforming and healing American masculinity over the last decade, I'm furious about it. Each morning I wake up, look at myself in the mirror, and wonder aloud, how did the tide turn back so quickly, so violently? How do we go from making steady progress toward healthy, whole masculinities to backsliding into gender oblivion? How did we lose so much feminist ground so quickly? The full answer to this question is complicated, but if I had to pick one idea that began our collective feminist unraveling, it's no contest. Our feminist objection was guaranteed the moment we began using the term toxic masculinity. The moment we began calling masculinity toxic, we lost most men wholesale. Not only did we lose men, we made political enemies of them. Investing in and subsequently popularizing the term toxic masculinity has been the great strategic blunder of the past decade of popular feminist discourse. Not because it's wrong to proclaim the myriad ways in which men hurt the world and themselves, but because men, the very people the term is intended to engage, can be relied upon to misunderstand us every time we use it. The trouble with the term toxic masculinity begins with the fact that it isn't literal. Masculinity is not a molecule or a chemical. You cannot ingest, inhale, or inject it. Factually speaking, there's no such thing as a toxic gender. You can't slip masculinity into someone's coffee in order to poison them, let alone hold the stuff. Gender is an abstraction, folks. Toxic masculinity isn't even a metaphor, really. It's the suggestion of one. In order to be correctly understood, it must be correctly interpreted. Every time we say toxic masculinity, we are wrongfully assuming that men will be able to take those two words and make appropriate meaning out of them. In a dream world, men would hear toxic masculinity and arrive at something like the following definition. Toxic masculinity, a specific subset of traits derived from conventional, socially constructed masculinity that, though they are not inherent to men, are metaphorically toxic to both men exhibiting those traits and everyone who interacts with men exhibiting those traits. Then, after correctly defining the term, people would go on to identify an apt metaphor, something like, toxic masculinity is lead paint. It hurts everyone who comes into contact with it. Men are the painters, compelled to apply lead paint to the walls in order to eat and pay their bills. The rest of us are forced to live in those lead-painted rooms. Everyone, from the painters to the people living within the painted walls, is subjected to harm. Everyone ends up ingesting the toxin. No one is spared, and it hurts us all. If we lived in that platonic ideal of a feminist universe, we could responsibly use the term to our heart's content. We could throw it around everywhere, at town halls and on social media alike, and we'd all be on the same page about what we're actually saying. But that's not the world we're living in. Instead, the term toxic masculinity has backfired completely. It's taken on an imprecise and increasingly destructive life of its own. A gargantuan society-wide game of telephone wherein the self-image of all men, the efficacy of feminism, and the future of democracy itself were on the line. The game went as it always does. As knowledge was passed from person to person, it degraded. The term went from something compelling, an avenue that invited men into a conversation about how aspects of masculinity were hurting them alongside us, into a trite accusation that all men are inherently and irreparably bad. The meaning got twisted beyond repair. We went from proclaiming men as sometimes wielding a toxic substance to proclaim men as a toxic substance. We went from talking about men metaphorically using lead paint to men being the lead. In our mind's eye, men were no longer operating the nuclear reactor. They were the uranium. The reason men hate the term toxic masculinity is because it leaves them no room for redemption. If a man is painting with lead, he need only switch paint to stop harming himself and those around him. But if a man is the lead, what can he do? Wish himself out of existence? Scrape himself from the walls? A poison dart frog cannot scrub the poison from its skin. A venomous snake cannot will away its fangs. Though many people would prefer to infantilize men and act as if they're devoid of complex understanding, men have picked up on this shift in meaning, and it hasn't exactly been subtle, and they've felt it. They've heard it, implied from every direction. Their very gender, the sum of who they are, is toxic. Masculinity itself is harmful and dangerous and irredeemable. But what a brutal thing to say to a boy. What a horrible thing for a man to say, to hear. For someone to proudly proclaim in public that the sum of you is toxic. For someone to say that the essence of you, how your parents raised you, and how you operate in the community is poison, living in your very skin. For someone to imply that because you're a man, you are necessarily a fanged creature burgeoning with venom, beyond redemption, waiting to strike. And so, reasonably, protectively even, most men have shut down. They've dismissed us. They've left the chat over a game of telephone gone horribly awry. Because of our terrible linguistic choice, they've rightfully chosen to disengage from feminist discourse altogether. What's worse is that, as feminists, most of us have been too stubborn, short-sighted, or careless to grasp that it is, in fact, a misunderstanding. It's become a vicious cycle. We proclaim that certain aspects of masculinity can be toxic, but we do so in reductive and therefore imprecise and easy to misconstrue terms. Our opaque, easily misunderstood language leads men to reasonably hear that all masculinity is toxic, so they shut down or don't engage. You know, because it feels like an attack when someone implies that your gender is toxic. We take that as further evidence of exactly how toxic they are. In retaliation, we proclaim even more loudly in language that is increasingly acerbic and imprecise that all men are toxic. They retaliate by lashing out at us. We retaliate by lashing back at them. The cycle continues. Nobody learns. No one is healed. And everything just gets worse. Like, so much worse. Every day, the news is a fresh hellscape. Every day, we spiral closer and closer to fascism. Democracy itself is at risk, almost exclusively due to the actions of broken, angry young men. Men who had their self-image, in part, broken by us and our flagrant use of the term toxic masculinity. Our basic constitutional rights are under daily assault. And if I have to choose between living in a democracy and continuing to use the term toxic masculinity, I'm going to choose democracy every single time. At this point, it's clear. We need new, fresh ways to engage men and make them a part of our feminist movement. Developing a strategy that achieves this is going to take a while. We'll have to use all our feminist ingenuity, strength, and brilliance to get it done. But it starts with learning to care about men and the effect our language has on them. If we want men to be part of our feminist movement, we have to use messaging that works for them and brings them into the fold. We have to stop decrying masculinity and begin crafting positive, encouraging visions of the stuff instead. So, stop using toxic masculinity as if your future depends on it. After all, it probably does. The painful truth behind the Trump administration's misleading claims about Tylenol during pregnancy. And this article is by Bethany Heitman. Toughing it out is not acceptable medical advice, yet that's so often the reality in women's healthcare. You're in labor, of course it hurts, an anesthesiologist said to me with an eye roll. I was 9 centimeters dilated, and despite repeatedly saying that I didn't think my epidural was working, I was ignored. After a total of 39 hours, my labor had stopped progressing, and the decision was made that I needed a C-section. I reiterated that I was feeling way more pain than I thought I should be with an epidural. Once again, I was ignored. As my doctor began to dissect my lower abdomen, the hot, searing pain was all-encompassing. I screamed. I kicked my legs, a sure sign that the epidural was supposed to make me immobile. From the waist down, it was indeed not working. My doctor yelled at the anesthesiologist, and he finally took what I had been saying seriously. Nearly 5 years later, I am still sometimes awakened in the middle of the night by that phantom pain. Not just of the scalpel sinking into my skin, but also of having my pain during such a vulnerable time so carelessly dismissed. I was reminded of that experience this week as I watched the President of the United States announce that the FDA would be updating drug labeling to discourage pregnant women from taking acetaminophen. More chilling, perhaps, than his unproven claims of a causal link between the common painkiller and autism was his caveat that women be prescribed only, he said, if you can't tough it out. He had spoken aloud what a doctor, a spouse, a boss, or a parent stopped short of saying to so many women at one time or another, or maybe didn't. While the president's fringe beliefs are shaping federal guidelines, they do not reflect those of actual health experts. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, the American Academy of Family Physicians, and the Society for Maternal-Fetal Medicine all emphasize that using acetaminophen while pregnant is a safe and effective way to manage pain and reduce fevers, and that there is no credible, scientifically proven causal link between the medication and rates of autism in children. In more than two decades of research on the use of acetaminophen in pregnancy, not a single reputable study has successfully concluded that the use of acetaminophen in any trimester of pregnancy causes neurodevelopmental disorders in children, said Stephen J. Fleischman, MD, the president of the ACOG, in a statement. In fact, the two highest quality studies on this subject, one of which was published in JAMA last year, found no significant associations between the use of acetaminophen during pregnancy and children's risk of autism, ADHD, or intellectual disability. To survive this turbulent period in United States politics, I've learned to tune out a lot of the nonsense and to seek out facts from more reliable sources. But this latest spewing of misinformation and subsequent FDA actions has been harder for me to shake. It underscores the idea that we live in a society that is as quick to sacrifice a mother's pain management as it is to shame her for expressing it. Acetaminophen is widely considered to be one of the safest pain medications for pregnant women. To cite studies incorrectly in order to deter women from taking it is cruel and dangerous, since high fevers during pregnancy can harm developing babies. And what about the moms of children with autism? The sudden implication is that those women did something wrong by taking this benign medication, and that they are the reason their children now live with this diagnosis. The sad truth is we just don't know enough about what causes the disorder, and there is not enough valid conclusive evidence yet to point fingers at one single cause. Sadly, the idea that pain and discomfort are just a part of being a woman starts when we are young and persists throughout our entire lives. A 2024 study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences found that female patients are less likely to be prescribed pain medication than males with similar pain scores. Another study suggests that the minimization of severe menstrual pain by both women experience it and healthcare providers contributes to the diagnostic delays of conditions like endometriosis. And then there is menopause. Similar to fake news around acetaminophen and autism, an early 2000 study linked hormone therapy, HT, to an increased risk of developing breast cancer, stroke, and heart disease. Panic spread after its publication, and practically overnight, doctors stopped prescribing hormone replacement, and women were left to deal with the debilitating side effects of menopause on their own. A reanalysis of that study, along with new research, has since found that HT has far more benefits than risks for both perimenopausal and menopausal women, including potentially life-saving benefits for the brain, cardiovascular, and musculoskeletal systems. Nonetheless, the damage was done more than two decades ago, and advocates are still working hard to reframe HT so women don't feel they have to white-knuckle it through this seismic transition. I fear the only option we currently have to fight back is determined, stubborn self-advocacy, which unfortunately puts the onus once again on women. When I gave birth to my second child this past January, I had extensive conversations with both my doula and obstetrician. This resulted in a call with the hospital's head of anesthesiology a week before my due date to review my chart and come up with ways to make sure what had happened last time wouldn't happen again. Spoiler alert, once again, my epidural didn't take full effect. Even though I had a plan, I wavered and wondered if I should just grin and bear it, if it was just part of being a woman. As my brain started down this very unpleasant path, my doula swooped in, reminding me that I could use my voice to demand the care I deserved. Minutes later, my obstetrician came in to reiterate the same. The next time the anesthesiologist came in to check, I firmly and clearly explained that we needed to figure out a solution that would address my pain, which resulted in higher dosages and more monitoring. Women should not have to fight to have our pain taken seriously, yet here we are. Whether it is for the misinformation surrounding acetaminophen, HT, and menopause, or any other medical event, if our pain is being minimized, the answer is not to tough it out. It's to get tough with those who misuse misinformation to further their own agenda and try to gaslight us and shame us into submission. Why so many couples are opting for a silent divorce? And this article is by Cassie Hurwitz. Because depending on your finances or the ages of your kids, you might not be ready to rip off the Band-Aid just yet. Even when it's amicable, getting divorced is devastating. The financial costs, legal fees, moving costs, child and spousal support, to name just a few, are crushing, and the logistics are a nightmare, especially if you share custody of kids. Then there's the soul-draining emotional toll of telling everyone, enduring months or years of negotiation and or litigation, and untangling all your bank accounts and belongings. Now, rather than dealing with the massive upheaval of a full legal split, some couples are ending things more quietly. The name for this phenomenon is silent divorce, and it's when a pair is no longer together emotionally or physically, but remains legally married. They're sleeping apart, and sex and romance are completely off the table, but they might still be living together, co-parenting, going on joint family vacations, and sharing bank accounts and bills, explains Matt Lundquist, a licensed psychotherapist and founder of Tribeca Therapy. Is this advisable? Whether you're curious, considering, or going through one without realizing it, here are four things to know about silent divorce. 1. Silent divorce can be a financial necessity. Few people actually want to stick around once the marriage is dead and done, but couples who silent divorce might not have a choice due to their finances. There's the reality of housing costs, Lundquist says. Couples stay together short term because they can't afford to move out. Yes, it's awkward for your ex-partner to sleep on the sofa bed, but expecting them to immediately take on a monthly rent, particularly in this calamitous economic climate, is a tall order too. Clear boundaries and open communication are essential to making this living arrangement work, adds Lundquist. Have a grown-up conversation, maybe an agreement of don't ask, don't tell, he suggests. Doing so in the presence of a therapist is never a bad idea. Or decide to hold off on dating until you move to the next phase. 2, it's also common when couples have kids. Some couples silent divorce because they want to delay a full split until their children are a little bit older, as in almost out of the nest or fully launched, or when they're better able to process the news. Kids are so vulnerable to wishful thinking, Lundquist says, that it's natural to worry they might mistake a friendly conversation or hug between ex-spouses as grounds for a third remake of the Parent Trap. With that in mind, going the silent divorce route for a period can allow couples to do some internal grieving and make decisions together before sharing them with the kids, Lundquist says. But staying mom isn't a foolproof way to protect kids' feelings. Lundquist says that if you opt to keep your separation a secret, they'll pick up on the vibes eventually. Also, the why don't you sleep in the same room anymore question is a doozy. Instead, he recommends allowing yourself a beat to process this new normal, then making a plan to share the news with kids when the time is right. You can lift the silence on a need-to-know basis. A silent divorce is nobody's business, but splitting up is hard, and to avoid going through it alone, Lundquist recommends bringing a few trusted, essential people into the fold. Telling a babysitter or teacher might save you from logistical headaches about pickups, or updating emergency contact info, and best friends, parents, or siblings can be crucial confidants. A therapist can help you work through all of the emotional complications, too. Be protective of yourselves as individuals and think about what the relationship needs, Lundquist says. If that means your judgy sister finds out last, so be it. And number four, it shouldn't be a secret forever. Lundquist says that silent divorces are difficult to sustain for loads of reasons, both emotional and logistical. At some point, someone is going to notice that you're not sharing a room anymore. That doesn't necessarily mean they're a bad idea. In the short term, a silent divorce can help with the grieving, transitioning, and supporting each other through the process, he says. Emphasis on short term. Ending a relationship is hard, Lundquist continues. There are benefits to being in one other than sex, love, co-parenting, and money. There's companionship and someone to count on. With that said, beware of leaning on a silent divorce as a way to maintain familiarity or not face your fear of being alone. Keeping a timer on the situation is ideal when possible. This way, you'll have your eye on the horizon rather than being stuck in the silence. Renesting is the new empty nesting. And this article is by Tembi Locke. Best-selling author and actress Tembi Locke, on how she reframed the painful transition when her only child left home for college into an empowering new chapter. I stopped short of the cracked wooden steps leading to my front door, putting the Trader Joe's bags full of groceries for my family of three on the ground. In 11 weeks, my 18-year-old daughter would be leaving for college across the country. Soon I'd be buying two artichokes, not three, for dinner. All at once, the full impact of my daughter leaving home hit me. I must have looked lost, standing in front of my own house, because my neighbor, the opera singer with a French bulldog mix, asked if I needed help. I declined. I didn't need help with my groceries. I needed help with something bigger and less tangible, navigating my way through the in-between of two life stages. My daughter was growing up, in a way, her rite of passage. I knew this day was coming, of course. Kids grow up and they leave home, mostly. That is the order of events in America. The thing we as parents are all supposed to be working toward. Independence Day, a declaration of autonomy. But that day, the usual stiffness in my neck tightened and my stomach went into free fall as I thought of her absence from the home I had built for her. Why was this hitting me so hard when everything was seemingly right, good, and perfectly normal? Why didn't I feel more prepared for this moment? Why was everyone else quietly struggling this hard? Who else couldn't bring groceries into the house? Even though I felt alone, I knew that I wasn't. A week earlier, after my daughter's graduation ceremony, I gathered with other families for a school-sponsored dinner party, where I witnessed other moms pass around tablets of Atvian like they were Tic Tacs, something I'd never seen before. They swapped stories on the merits or misses of melatonin versus CBD. Over the course of the evening, our mom's group chat shared a flurry of links about how to sleep in the midst of anxiety. WTF is going on, I thought. Why were we navigating the graduation dinner like someone was pushing us off a cliff when we had spent years walking ourselves up to its edge? I suspected my own anxiety was masking a free-floating grief. This was something I had felt in fits and starts for my daughter's entire senior year, but didn't feel I had full permission to discuss openly. It didn't feel socially acceptable when we were so busy celebrating our children, editing their college essays, and preparing them to leave home. There was so much emphasis on forward motion, their promise and possibility. There was very little emphasis on the fact that the children were not the only ones embarking on new territory. When they leave home, we parents start down a path of reimagining home, our lives, our interests, our relationships with each other. But instead of seeing this transition as an open horizon, we are taught to imagine it as an empty nest. The term empty nest has never really resonated with me. It sounds outdated and frankly pejorative. Empty connotates a kind of physical and emotional void that neither I nor many of my friends could relate to. Talking to other parents with children on the cusp of emerging adulthood, I find that modern American families don't seem to relate to their children leaving home and their nests being forever empty in the way previous generations once did. I remember when turning 18 meant heading out the door and hardly looking back. I remember weekly phone calls and visits only at holidays, nothing in between. But that kind of separation is rarer today. Parents are more connected to kids because technology allows us to communicate in ways previously unimaginable. And with average student debt exceeding $35,000, combined with the rising cost of rent, children are staying home for college and beyond. The old ways are as outdated as the payphone. I called home from my dorm room hallway. Today we can see that the entire nest changes, the child changes, and so do the parents' guardians. And while the era of intense hands-on day-to-day care is over, our input, influence, and very presence is not over. Instead, we began a season of shifting boundaries and soft goodbyes. Soon after my breakdown with the groceries, I had a routine appointment with my doctor where I mentioned Boston, the college dropout. Three of his adult kids had made similar choices to study far away from home. He shook his head, took a deep breath, and said, "Get ready. You're about to get fired." Almost instantly, I lost the thread of the conversation. "What are you talking about?" I asked. He responded, "This is the moment, if she hasn't already, when she will fire you. Basically, your job is done, as far as kids are concerned." Sweat seeped under the arms of my paper gown. He pressed on. "It happens fast, no warning. Suddenly, you have no real say. Think of it as taxation without representation. You pay the bills, but you can't really control what happens." I was so lost in the mixed metaphors of job loss and taxes, but I felt a truth rising up. He must have seen it on my face. I furrowed my brow, cocked my head to the side, blinked repeatedly to make sense of what I was hearing. Fired? Yes, fired. But here's the silver lining. How you handle it, how you handle this breakup will determine if you get rehired as a consultant in their adult lives. Over the next weeks, I contemplated what his comment meant to me, how I handled my anxiety and grief over her leaving home. Whether it got clingy or controlling or micromanagerial might determine whether she felt open, safe, and free to return to me later for advice, wisdom, involvement, or friendship. I knew feelings of loss were a trigger for me. I knew I was primed to feel unmoored. I knew this because after my first husband died of cancer when our daughter was 7, I spent the first years as a widow completely lost, trying to function in a world and a life I didn't recognize. Ultimately, being a mom had been my salvation because it made me show up. It made me engage with life, investing in living. My daughter was the reason I got dressed, put gas in the tank, cooked, didn't sell everything I owned, and moved to Argentina and learned a tango, despite the sleepless nights telling me that this was the answer to the end of my heartache. Each time I looked in her eyes, I stopped running alternate scenarios of how my life might write itself in the presence of his goneness. I saw my ultimate purpose. I knew we would both benefit if she didn't have a mother who ran from grief, but instead tried to integrate the bitter and sweet life after loss. I suspected I'd have to navigate this new and different sense of loss also by investing in life, my own, with intention and intuition. By the end of my daughter's sophomore year, she had not fired me. Being consultant meant listening more and asking up front what she needed from me before launching into advice. These were new learnings for us both. Those first few years of re-nesting were a season of transformation, bringing new questions, dynamics, and expansion. We had our bumps, miscues, renegotiations of boundaries, and I began predicting the rhythms in our togetherness and separation. Looking back on that day in front of my house with the groceries, I wish I had known enough to say to my neighbor, "I'm about to do a hard but beautiful thing, and I don't know what life will look like on the other side." I wish I had a word to describe the internal and external work that was about to take place, that I wasn't about to merely empty the nest, that I was about to rebuild it, that re-nesting asks of us a new intentionality, that if done with love, vulnerability, and grace, it can empower mothers to claim the season of change with wisdom and radical curiosity as we walk into new and sometimes unseen possibilities. After all, we made the nest. We can also change it.
Hold your head as high as you can, high enough to see who you are, little man.
Run out of time for today's episode of Oprah. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to tune in next time. I'm Tyra Banks from the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long, until next time. If you have questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138.